a lot of times, I think one of the most important things that sometimes gets us forgotten in marketing maybe is that, like, there are a lot of people, like, coming to this party. You've got the brand, you've got a creator or influencer, you've got their audience, you've got the needs and changes and whims of the platforms. And so there are a lot of different parties in every equation. Sometimes marketers can forget and just be like, this is the message, this is our product, this is the message we want out there. And they're not thinking about, is this good for the creator? Is this good for their audience or interesting for their audience?
Yep.
Is this gonna work with how the platform is evolving and how good storytelling takes place on that platform? And so I think that that's what I bring, or I think a big part of the reason that I'm brought in to help on projects.
Explore the minds and marketing strategies behind today's winning brands and businesses. Tap into the power of the creator economy with Earned by Creator IQ. Here's Connor Begley.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Earned. Today, we've got Leah Haberman on the show. Welcome to the show, Leah.
Thank you, Connor. Glad to be here.
I think my favorite part about this is we got connected through my own journey creating content online. And like, you're one of the handful of friends I've made. And it's been so fun to watch you, from my perspective, grow your own practice. You are on fire, it looks like.
Wow, thanks. You just set a high bar there that I got to measure up to, but I appreciate that. We all have friends that we've made online, right? People we've never met, but that I consider, like, you're in my address book. Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
And for those that don't know Leah, so she is an instructor at UCLA. She teaches courses literally on becoming an influencer, which is like the fact that that's a job is just my favorite thing in the world. Has been a CMO in the past at a variety of brands, spent time at E! News, spent time at Livestrong. That's on the editorial side. And then now a consultant to a bunch of brands that you would know, consultant, advisor, et cetera. And where I got to know her is now publishing on the creator economy, and you've got like 10 plus thousand subscribers on your newsletter. You've got your LinkedIn account that's thousands of people.
15,000, like, but who's counting?
It's just so cool. So I'm excited for today. Let's start at the beginning. So you're sitting E! Newsroom 2002 as a news editor. Did you imagine that you'd be teaching a course on personal branding and becoming an influencer at UCLA? Was that the plan back then?
It was not, you know, looking back, and I have people ask me all the time, like, how did you know to jump from digital to social to influencers to hiring influencers and kind of working as a marketer, working in the wellness space, working for creators, starting a newsletter? And looking back, it looks like my path was very intentional. And I wish I could say like it was all part of some master plan. It wasn't. I followed a lot of culture and technology and as it shifted. But I think the early things from working at E, and it was such a great time, I think, in the aughts to be working at E, and for a few reasons. Celebrities were the original influencers, right? That was who got to talk, who we listened to. But in the aughts, it was shifting. Even before social media, you had people like, this was the era of Paris Hilton, Lindsay Lohan, Britney Spears, Nicole Richie, all of these people. So you had these young women that were starting to shape the narrative in a way that we hadn't seen before. They weren't influencers yet. I think we called them like starlets, celebutants. We had different names, not always very nice names for these people at this era. But there was a shift where like not every message was going through a publicist or a manager. They would go out and do things that would get reported on by TMZ, for example. And they would speak to TMZ and it would be on the website the next day. So they were starting to take control of the narrative. It's easy to look back now and be like, wow, that was so intentional. And I think Paris Hilton, still around, still very smart in kind of the way that she's shaped her career. You know, maybe like me, it was also a lot of like happy accidents that kind of it seemed like she was taking control of the narrative. Maybe the narrative at the time wasn't great, but at least she was in control of it. The other thing that I got from working at E! Was I managed the message boards. And that was before you had social media, you had message boards online. And there I really learned the value of community, audience. There might be trolls, but like the fandom would come in and fight the trolls, but even the trolls in could gather around something that they loved. So like that was super powerful to see, okay, there was a show or an actor that people loved and would gather around. And there was huge power to that. The last thing I think is that I was there for almost a decade, and that was with the rise of social media. There were some actors that were very early adopters. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Arnold Schwarzenegger has been on Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat, TikTok. Like, he is a pro at jumping on a platform, understanding how to use it. Ashton Kutcher, Kevin Jonas of the Jonas Brothers, Channing Tatum. Channing Tatum was very early on Twitter. And we used to do polls on the E! News Twitter handle. And we'd ask, who do you want to see in our like front page spotlight today? We'd do a poll and we'd list some actors. And then after we ran the poll in the morning, we'd go and buy Getty Images or whatever. And that person would kind of have like the prime spot on the website. Channing Tatum, very early on, he doesn't really do this anymore, but this was at the time as Twitter was rising in importance at the time. He would reach to his followers. Every time Channing Tatum retweeted the poll, Channing Tatum would win. There was like a disproportionate amount, probably around 2010, 2011. Like there was a disproportionate amount of Channing Tatum on the front page of the E! Website. And it was because he would get his fans activated. And so you could have other people on the poll that had more money, more Oscars, even, you know, more social followers. But like Channing Tatum was engaged with his audience. And so seeing the power of that was super powerful to me. And I think it was just a great education in, okay, who gets to control the narrative? Who gets to own the share of voice? Also, tech and culture is constantly evolving and you can't get too tied to any one thing because it's just going to keep changing. And like, who gets to hold the mic? The technology that you use to transmit that story is just going to keep changing. So when I look back, I think it was a really great education or kind of like a good training boot camp for what the rest of my career was going to be.
That is so fascinating. I had never thought about that. Because obviously, like you said, the earliest influencers were all celebrities, right? Because it took a minute for you to be able to be like, I started on YouTube and I got really big, right? It was like, I'm already well known. Now I've started publishing on Twitter and like, I can build an audience. So I just never thought about that. But it's like, you had front row seat to that evolution, which is super cool. I'm curious, I don't have as much of a lens into like, kids that are 18, 19, 20, 21, 22 that are like starting to look at this and going, hey, I want to do that. What is the perspective that your students are coming into these classes with? Now, obviously, UCLA is right in the heart of the entertainment scene. What is their approach? What's their level of sophistication? Like, tell me about the students for a second.
You know, it's interesting. So I teach different classes. I teach social marketing. I teach marketing from employing influencers, but then also, like you said, personal branding and becoming an influencer. And what I'm seeing among the students is a lot of what I'm seeing reflected in the industry, especially like at a junior level or like early career stage level, where people come in as marketers, but also want to be influencers or creators or are already. And then the people that are coming in as influencers or creators and want more training in that also want to pick up the marketing skills so that not only for their own careers, but then also because everybody understands that there is a certain volatility to being an influencer or a creator. And I think a lot of people are smart in thinking, I'm going to do this if it doesn't work out, or, you know, in 5 years, I decide like, this is not what I want to do anymore. These are transferable skills. I can go be a social media manager, a marketer. From my perspective, that's one of the big things that I'm seeing. I feel like when you say creator and social media manager, those are almost interchangeable at this point. Almost everybody comes into class with a social audience already, whether it's 500, 1,000 people, whether it's 40,000 or 100,000 people. Everybody's already coming in with an audience, with social accounts, with an expectation that they're going to be online and publishing in some way. I think that's been super interesting. Are they as obsessively following every little update as I kind of expect them to be? Like, I'm like, hey, did you guys hear there's a new YouTube mobile editing tool coming out? And like, they might have missed that. I don't think that they're quite as granular on kind of like every little update. But they're looking at the big themes. They all follow creators. Like everybody follows an influencer, a creator, multiple of them. The other thing I would say too is that people expect to be marketed to. One of the things that I found most shocking is, you know, sometimes we've looked at examples, and this was like 2018, 2019. When I first started there, there were some blatant examples of influencers who would stage scenarios to sell something. And I think if you Google something like, I think it's like a Listerine campaign that was very early on, there was an influencer who kind of like staged her bedroom for a Listerine campaign. And there were a lot of things that were not very authentic about it. And I was shocked and I thought like, oh, this doesn't ring true. And we all know like authenticity is such a buzzword. And I asked the students about it and they were like, she needs to get paid. It's okay. Like, this doesn't offend me. This doesn't bother me that, you know, things are placed just so, or maybe like, why would you have this next to your bed instead of in the bathroom? And it didn't bother them. And that I thought was interesting. And I think is a good lesson to me in talking to students every week is like, put your own biases and judgment aside and really listen to, you know, for me, it's the students. It might be your audience, might be your customers, but like what people are talking about, because a lot of times we come with these preconceived notions of this is the way to do it. This is what consumers want. This is what we should say. This is the technology we should be using. And that might not be the case. And I think that that's a really, really important lesson to learn in like respecting the audience, respecting your community, respecting your customers, and actually listening versus assuming you know the right way to do things.
You said it and it like hit me. And I don't know why it's never hit me before. But every person that's coming into your class has an audience on social, some of them very large audiences, which is so weird because you'd forget how many of these influencers, creators, whatever you want to call them, are like really young, right? Like have huge audiences, and that they are thinking about that as just being an integrated part of their life. Like, this is just part of my life. That is such a weird concept. I don't know why like every one of those students is thinking that way already at such a young age.
And you should assume as an employer, assume that everyone joining your company is probably a nano or micro influencer. And like, how do you harness that to your benefit and consider that an asset versus, I think 10 years ago, maybe we would have thought that was a liability. And now it's an asset.
Yeah, I had Peter Hollins on, who's like a very large YouTuber. And he was like really preaching this, like, the people you want running your social are the people that are really good already at running their own social, right? Like running their own accounts. Like, you want to hire creators to run your accounts. After we did the interview, he's like, hey, I did a bunch of cuts of your podcast. Is it cool if I use these? And I looked at him like, these are the best cuts we've ever had. I should be hiring him to be running. It's like, this is crazy. Let's talk about a little bit about you as a creator, right? You're watching this whole thing happen. And I think one of my favorite kind of meta concepts, like I just did an interview with Avi, who's the head of influencers at Patreon, longtime talent agent. He's become a really prominent creator economy influencer because I was actually looking at trying to buy. I was like, what's the best creator economy publications that we could go out and buy? And there's some people that are doing a really good job, right? You got The Information's doing a good job, Insider's doing a good job. But then I was like, I think the people that are actually doing the best job are the people, like the individuals, which is like amazing. So I'm curious, what made you decide to start hitting the publish button yourself? And then how did you grow that to tens of thousands of subscribers now?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And again, I feel like so much in my career is just kind of like listening, whether you call it social listening or just like listening to what's going on, like in tech and culture. I was on social since essentially like social came around. There's really two reasons the newsletter started. And I've talked about one publicly and the other I haven't. So I'll kind of share it today. So the first reason was that I had a student who actually now works at Meta. We've stayed in touch. We're friends. She's like a brilliant young woman. She actually asked me as my class was wrapping up, and she said, how am I going to stay on top of all of these things that every week you talk to us about? I start every class with like, have you seen the headlines? This is happening. This is changing. Keep an eye on this. And she said, how am I going to keep up with this stuff? And I thought, okay, well, I put it on Twitter. She wasn't on Twitter, you know, and I thought, okay, how else can I reach her? And a couple of other students had asked as well. So I thought, okay, maybe I'm going to start a newsletter and I'll send out, could be an email blast. Coincidentally, Substack was just coming into, percolating into everyone's consciousness. This was in, I would say about 3 years ago, 4 years ago. And so I thought, okay, like, let me try this. It's an easy user-friendly solution. I'll start putting out the newsletter. And it really started as a bunch of bullet points, really as if I was sending an email to a few students, a few clients, some friends, just kind of like sending out a very casual email. Then the other reason that reinforced why I was sending out a newsletter, as you mentioned, I was a CMO for a fitness company that was run, founded by a creator turned entrepreneur. And I love her, Anna Victoria, wonderful person. I had hired her 5 years earlier for a few campaigns. And then she turned around and hired me. She had a fitness app. She was also launching supplements. So she's a very busy person. She's running this company. She's also an influencer. She was a new mom at the time. And, you know, there were only so many messages, Slack, email, we'd correspond, we'd have a touch base every morning, talk about business or whatever. I couldn't send her messages. I had a lot of thoughts and feelings. I wasn't running her accounts. I was running marketing for her business, but I had a lot of thoughts and feelings about what she was doing as a creator. And I didn't want to send Slack messages or emails every 5 minutes saying, do this, pay attention to this. I think you should be doing this content, focus more on YouTube. And so the newsletter became like a way of seeding information because I knew she read the newsletter. So even though we worked together, again, you don't want to be telling somebody what to do every 5 minutes. And, you know, she's really smart and a great influence. I mean, she grew her audience long before I came along. So she knew what she was doing clearly. But like, I just had extra tips that I kind of wanted to seed with her. And so using the newsletter was a really great way to kind of like seed that information. And I've talked to a lot of different corporate clients where people have said, like, how can we get this message out to people internally in the company and get them to pay attention? And I'm like, create a really great newsletter that everybody wants to read and seed that information in there. And everything I put that I've since moved on, and that's not really the purpose of the email, but it was like originally that was one of the reasons for the email.
A very sneaky way to get your founder to pay attention.
Yeah, it's very that I put in there, even now, even though the audience is broadened and there's different people that I'm thinking about, the information's really intentional that is in there. I'm trying to get people to perceive things in a certain way and to think about things, even if it's just like a headline and I don't go deep into it. Everything that's in there is very intentional, and everything that's not in there is also very intentional. So I don't want to waste space on Elon Musk and, you know, whatever the like latest outrage is, because that's not what I want to dedicate the newsletter to. I want you to be thinking about fractured social landscape, how creators are business people and you're working with them. And there's so many different ways you can work with them. The challenges of affiliate and e-commerce. How's AI going to impact us? Like, there are things that I want you to be thinking about that are going to be very relevant, whether it's in 6 months, a year, 2 years. And like, let's talk about those things. So I think even from the beginning, it's just been like a very intentional message around giving people the information and the confidence to understand what they're talking about. They go into a meeting and they're like, oh yeah, like I've seen something about this. I know that this is relevant, or it's probably not that important. So we can like, this is just a blip versus something that really has like a macro trend that really has long lasting impact.
That is such a cool evolution. And to your point, I've heard that story before about other newsletters have gotten to prominence where it's like, I just kind of started this for my friends and people I was connected with. And then they're like, wait, I want that too. We actually started our own newsletter. We have a newsletter, but a really good one about 4 weeks ago. And like people are freaking out like, oh shit, this is really good. And it's like, yeah, the thing I told them, we had a newsletter and people kept kicking it down the chain, kicked it down. Okay. It goes from director to this, to the cord. Okay. Now our coordinator is doing the newsletter. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? I'm like, who are our customers? Who are our people? Our people are professionals. Where do they live? They live in their inbox. That's where they live. And it is literally the number one marketing touch point we have as a company. This should be the highest level possible, right? Like this should be the place where we invest the most money, the most time, the most effort. And so we started doing it and people were like, oh shit. So that's awesome. I'm curious,
so much power, in a newsletter. Yeah.
Oh my God, so much power. And do it right. Do it well. Obviously, Morning Brew and others have kind of have really brought that to light in terms of how powerful it can be. So I'm curious, we've talked a lot about you on the marketing side, the creator economy side, and a little bit on the e-news side, but you know, you had a long career on the editorial side before you ever got to the marketing side, whether it was e or you were at Yahoo for a couple of years. Livestrong was a massive publisher that a lot of people don't really know that well. What did you draw from those experiences that you think helped grow you personally across whether it's email or LinkedIn or Twitter? What were some of those lessons that you learned?
I think have a point of view, first of all. And I think especially as a solopreneur, you want to find your voice and really bring something to it that's distinct and unique from what other people are doing. I think that's going to be the only thing that separates us from AI written newsletters moving forward is like, if I'm just delivering information with no perspective, no point of view, no analysis, what's the difference between my newsletter and just like a list that you could have almost like an RSS feed or again, like an AI generated newsletter. So, and I think that was something very early on. It's like, have a voice, have a personality, clearly, if you're working for a brand, like when I was working for E, we had a tone. When I was working for Yahoo, it was a different tone. But there was still always the ability, especially on social. Social was always the easier place to kind of develop that personality. And so think about your social voice or your newsletter voice or whatever as a persona. And just like an influencer and having worked with traditional celebrities and then with influencers, they're personas. Like, you don't see all of them, even the people who share their morning routine, their get readies with me, their fit check, whatever. There's still parts of them that you don't see. Like, it's a carefully curated persona that shows up. So you really want to like lean into that. Obviously, it should be as honest and authentic and close to the truth as possible, but it's definitely a version of you. And then I think also listening to the audience. And so both from my perspective and then also from working at media brands, understanding what the audience wants to read, respecting that, looking at the analytics, what people are clicking into, never letting your own judgment cloud what people enjoy. And that was something, it was kind of an interesting, I worked at Yahoo, it's been a while now, but when I worked at Yahoo, there was a little bit of a disconnect in like, at that time, there was a decision made to go a little bit more highbrow. There were certain types of stories or people or news that got covered through a lens of trying to, I don't know if it was like compete with like a Vanity Fair, but like looking at that audience. That was not necessarily the audience that Yahoo had at that time or what they wanted to click on the front page. And I think it taught me a really good lesson in, I don't have to like the stories necessarily that people are clicking on, but like if they're interested in finding out more about, I don't know, the Kardashians or something, it's irrelevant whether or not I like the Kardashians. What's important is that people have an appetite for this stuff. And I think you have to respect whether it's a reader, an audience, a community, a consumer, a customer, you got to respect what people want. Clearly, you're not going to let them dictate the business. But I think if you have an already established audience, it does like a huge disservice and disrespect to say, oh, we're pivoting. We don't want those people. If your customer is like a 35-year-old woman from, let's say, Texas or Florida, and you're like, no, we want Gen Z, New York, and Los Angeles. Like, it's a huge disrespect to kind of pivot and forget that audience that you already have. Clearly, it depends on like the life cycle of your business. I'm not talking about startup. Startup phase, you're determining like, this is who we're going after. I think for more, whether it's legacy businesses or more established businesses, media businesses, you have an audience and you've got to respect who they are and not be like, this is tacky or cheesy or embarrassing. Like, no, we want to go much more highbrow, because it's like, don't disrespect the people who have been loyal to you and who are already existing customers. You can try and incorporate like a new audience demographic that you're going after. But I think it's important to always respect and listen to the audience that you have.
Yeah. And I think to your point, follow the signal, right? So like when you're putting stuff out, especially as you're growing an audience, like I started publishing whatever, 6-7 months ago. And it's like, as you put stuff out, you get feedback like, hey, I really like this. Like, this is really good. Lean into those things. Now, obviously, like we had Dolma on here, who's a, she's become like a really big TikToker. Yeah, she's amazing. The one she got famous for was a Kardashians video. And she's like, oh, like that's now become her audience. And not in a bad way. I'm not trying to make it sound too bad, yeah, but
we're not bashing on the Kardashians. They're like a hugely influential, very smart family that has made billions of dollars.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, they're like, in a lot of ways, the face of this industry, right? So anyways, but it is tough, that balance between like, okay, this content worked, but actually, I don't know if I like it that much. Like, it's difficult. I'm curious for you, so two questions. One question is, and you talked about it a little bit, from when you first started to today, how have you seen that content evolve? And then two, I've been really obsessed with this, and this is very well known in the publishing industry, but something that I've recently put words to, but is this idea of like recurring content franchises, like things that you're like, this hits, I'm doing it every week on the dot. So I'm curious, one, how has your writing changed? And for you, what are the like recurring content franchises that your people have latched onto that we should look out for?
So how's it changed? Well, like I said, when it first started, it was a bullet point list. There were no sections. Yep. There were no recurring franchises. It was just a bullet point list of things. So it's gotten more formatted, more thoughtful, I think. I put a little bit more time into it now, especially once I hit that 10,000 threshold. It was like, oh, And I started getting sponsors and I started getting subscriptions. I was like, oh, I need to spend a little bit more time on this, put a little more thought into it. What has evolved for me personally, what I've seen kind of be interesting is at the very top of my newsletter, it's called Roadmap and it's talking about platform updates. That tends to resonate really well with, let's say, social media managers. So people who are like either social media managers or creators who are like, I need very quickly a recap of what did TikTok, Instagram, or YouTube just roll out that I'm going to be able to start using next week or is going to change the way I talk to my community. And so that kind of appeals to a very specific person. The next section goes a little bit more in depth into whatever, if there's a trending news story or a topic that I think is really important to discuss. That's where I get a lot more outreach from, I would say, executive or leadership level people or people sharing or reaching out about these topics where I've spent a little bit more time. I think a lot of maybe social media managers or creators, they might read that next section, but sometimes it goes too in depth to something that doesn't have like an immediate relevance to the work that they're doing. And so that section tends to resonate more with people who are able to take a little bit of a step back. Maybe it's a CMO, maybe it's a VP, and they're able to take a step back and be like, oh, okay, I want to anticipate not what's coming today, tomorrow, next week. I want to be thinking about, are we getting ahead of where we should be in 6 months to a year? It's kind of interesting. And that's reflected too, I think, just like the different audiences that I speak to on social, that I speak to in my newsletter, like in my career, is that cross section of more of a leadership level, but then also wanting to make sure that I am helping, empowering, and informing the people that are coming up and need to be able to understand what's happening and what are the more tactical things that are going to impact their jobs in the next week or 2 weeks.
Totally. I like that. And there's a certain amount of like, you want to feel like you're in the know when you're the social media manager and you have other friends that are social media managers. Like, you don't want to be the one person that doesn't know about the platform update that happened last week. Like, you want to know what's happening like right now. And I think that's an underrated element of things, which is like, you're curating the headlines and the like short blips that I just need to know about this thing so that if it comes up in conversation, like I have ammunition to talk about it.
The greatest compliment that I get, people reach out to me on social, people email me, whatever, when people share screenshots of their company Slacks, where there's like a little screenshot of my newsletter and somebody's like, oh, I just saw this. And somebody else is like, oh, I read that newsletter too. Like, those are the moments that make me so happy because I realize like, yeah, it is really important and relevant for those people. I forgot you had asked a second question, which we didn't really get to. And what did you call it? You called it recurring
content franchises, right?
Recurring content franchises. I call it series, but I think content franchises, same thing. And I think maybe I just call it series coming from more of an entertainment background and thinking about like TV shows, for example. Huge fan of that. I think it's super important. I think it's important for creators to have series or recurring content franchises. I think it's important for brands to have that. We see customers or consumers, especially like when I was working in entertainment, it's like, that's what people love. They love the familiarity. They love like these recurring characters.
Don't make me think it's easy. I know what it is. Like, I can come back to it. Like,
I've talked about this in my newsletter for anybody that wants more. And especially if you're a creator and you're listening to this podcast and you're thinking like, well, I've got a niche and I always talk about housewares or, you know, whatever it is that you're like beauty products, that might be a content pillar, but that's not necessarily a series. And a series is going to be something. I always use Remy Bader as an example because she's a really great example. And she has these like Remy's realistic hauls. So when you go to Remy Bader on TikTok, on Instagram, there are like consistent themes to her content. She talks about similar things. She posts about events that she goes to, collaborations she's doing, brands, whatever. But then she has this content series, which is Remy's Realistic Hauls, which is where she tries clothes on in a very specific style that, like we said, like people are familiar. As soon as you see her standing there, you're like, oh, it's a Remy Realistic Haul.
Yes.
I know what I'm in for. I know what to expect. And so for creators, that's the way to think about it. It's going like super granular on a theme that you keep introducing to your content. And I think it's super important. Brands love it too, to be able to market through a creator, through like one of these series, like to be able to own this series. But I think brands can even have series on their own owned and operated channels and think about the audience knows what to expect. It's like a recurring chance to like get our message across. It breeds familiarity, loyalty. It's an opportunity for really great storytelling. It has to be compelling. Like you can't just not yep. any series is going to do. And you've really got to think about like, what is good storytelling? Who's telling the story? Is it more product integration than maybe product marketing, which tends to work better in series? There's so many opportunities, I think, both on the creator side and the brand side for recurring content series or content franchises. Even my newsletter is like broken into franchises or sections that are kind of like, you get to know like, okay, I've read this. Now I know the next thing that you're going to talk about is this type of topic. And then I'm going to get to bullet point headlines. And then I'm going to get to whatever it is. So it's the way that our minds think. Make it easy. Make it interesting. Make it familiar.
I think people get really focused on one-off campaigns, or I need to push this messaging, or I need to focus on this thing. You can actually do that within the confines, like you said, of like, hey, these are my halls, right? Or whatever, my realistic halls kind of thing. Everybody has a very small amount of space. Like I only have so much space for knowing Leah. And what do I know Leah for, right? I know Leah for ICYMI, right? Like in case you missed it, right? There's a small number of things I know you for. And so picking out like, these are the things I want to be known for. And that's going to be 70% of my content is this. There's going to be another 30% that's one-off, that's a little bit different, unique, whatever. But like figuring out the things like our podcast, it's the same format, similar design, similar distribution points, different people, different topics, but like there's an order to it and people get used to that and they get comfortable with it is something that I think a lot of people underestimate when they're creating content. So anyways, yeah. Love that.
You've got to think about it like a TV series and just think like you tune in, you expect familiarity, you expect the jingle or the theme music, you expect to see at least one familiar face, you know, even in like White Lotus, for example, it was like, you got Jennifer Coolidge, or there was some sort of something that was a carry through so that people could be like, yeah. Oh, I love the first one. I'm going to love this one. Yeah.
So one of the things that I think people face as they start to become a prominent creator influencer is like, hey, my audience is growing. Oh, wait, I can start to make some money off this thing. Oh, wait, is this my thing? Is this my like full-time thing? Like, am I a CMO? Am I a creator? Like, am I a publisher? What am I? And I'm curious for you how you're thinking about that. Like, is this the plan for a while? Or maybe it's a plan for now and we'll see what happens. Or do you want to go back to the CMO side of things? And if it is the plan, or I guess in both cases, I'm curious, how do you think about how it generates money, right? Monetization. Like, I know I would imagine consulting is obviously a big source of revenue, but you mentioned subscribers and there's a bunch of other ways to make money like ads and sponsorships. So would love you to talk about those two things, just how you're thinking about this as a career and then ultimately how that impacts how you personally make money.
So it's really interesting because I am, even though right now I seem fairly entrepreneurial, and I think I've always been kind of entrepreneurial, but always within the confines of a company. I've worked at a lot of, I would say, fairly big companies, you know, mid to large companies my entire career, and kind of was always really comfortable in that environment. I love working as part of a team. I love the resources that come with working with a big company. But now through the pandemic and a couple of layoffs and the newsletter started getting sponsors and then it started getting subscribers. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I had never really thought about, okay, I'm going to do this on my own. So the consulting to me was very similar to like I'm a team mascot for the companies that I work for. And I'm probably most comfortable in that environment. However, now that I can see, oh, okay, I could monetize the newsletter both through subscribers or through sponsors, it presents like an interesting option that I had not really considered before. In terms of like proportionally, maybe that's 30% of the revenue coming in versus like the consulting clearly pays a lot more. What that has done is actually make me very sympathetic to creators or to influencers. Anytime any of the platforms comes out with like a subscription feature, it's very, very hard to grow paying subscribers. You can grow followers when there's no money involved. It's very easy to grow followers. It's much harder to grow paying subscribers. And I'm not sure also that that's where I want to make my money. So I'm super grateful for the people that support me. But ultimately, I know that companies have a lot more money. And yep. I think especially for when I'm talking to influencers or advising like influencers, creators, the brands have the money. You can get paying subscribers, but if you're not able to scale that to like a Mr. Beast or an Alex Earl kind of level, it's never going to be like a meaningful source of revenue. The brands are the ones with money. And so that to me is kind of like a smarter play. So I think, again, super happy and grateful to the people that have supported me, to the sponsors that I have so far in the newsletter. You have to pick a direction, I think, for where to focus your efforts. And to me, you've got to look at who has the money, what is like a stable recurring source of revenue. Yep. And to me, brands and consulting is a more potentially lucrative, stable source of revenue that I want to focus my efforts on. Doesn't mean I'm going to not have paid subscribers, not have sponsors. I just see more stability as a creator. It depends, like, where are you at in your life? Where are you at in your career? Like, how conservative or not are you with your finances? So I think it's just understanding like who you are and what is going to make sense for you, and then making sure that you're doing that. Of course, everybody should diversify their revenue streams, especially if you're a creator. You want to think about like, okay, there are a lot of different ways that I can make money. But again, brands have money. And so that's the way that I think about it. Whether or not I would go in-house, I'm open to it. So recently, I've been consulting for a lot of different companies now for years. Recently, somebody asked me to write a version of my newsletter for the marketing team in-house. So take it to more of like a B2B product while still keeping all of the culture and the analysis that kind of I bring to my newsletter. So that was a really interesting development that now makes me think like, that's kind of an interesting, not every company is going to be able to do that clearly, but I think for the ones that I'm interested in working with, that all of a sudden becomes like a really appealing option. I'm always going to keep a version of my newsletter out there. I feel really strongly about helping people that maybe are in the early stages of their career, helping them get a leg up, sharing information with them, making sure that they have like the knowledge and the confidence to be able to go into meetings and sound like they know what they're talking about. That's just important to me from a purpose-driven sense. But in terms of, oh, okay, what fulfills me creatively and financially, it's working more closely with larger companies that need that perspective, that outside perspective or analysis or critical thinking about the industry and about where things are going. A lot of times, I think one of the most important things that sometimes gets forgotten in marketing maybe is that like there are a lot of people like coming to this party. You've got the brand, you've got a creator, influencer, you've got their audience, you've got the needs and changes and whims of the platforms. And so there are a lot of different parties in every equation. Sometimes marketers can forget and just be like, this is the message. This is our product. This is the message we want out there. And they're not thinking about, is this good for the creator? Is this good for their audience or interesting for their audience? Yep. Is this going to work with how the platform is evolving and how good storytelling takes place on that platform? And so I think that that's what I bring, or I think a big part of the reason that I'm brought in to help on projects.
Yeah, I mean, we talk a lot about when you're running this initiative, you should think about how this affects their audience, right? And their relationship with their audience. And I think the other thing too there that's kind of misunderstood about this industry is that 95% of the people that create content, including you and me and Avi and every other category, like I remember I was trying to decide on what car to buy, and there's some car dealership in Lincoln, Nebraska that's like doing reviews of every car. And like, they are not making money via their content. That is not how they make money, right? They don't directly monetize their audience in that way. They make money, they use it to support another business. Or like, you know, there's a real estate agent that's become like a very prominent real estate agent in New York and had no background in it. And all he would do is shoot really cool tours of these massive mega mansions. And that would be the way that he'd help sell the mansions, right? Is like essentially a marketing tour for the mansion itself. But he built up a big audience doing those. And so it's fascinating to see how that evolves. I'm curious, as kind of a wrap-up question. So you've had a lot of perspective. You talked to a lot of brands. When you look at the brands that have done a really good job, kind of a best-in-class job at working with influencers, how would you describe their approach? How would you describe how they're working with creators?
The first answer is like start 10 years ago. I would say the second answer would be...
You can fake that though. You can hire people that started 10 years ago and they bring their relationships with them. That's a good way to fake it.
I think it's important to acknowledge that when you're hiring an influencer, they're not just like a living ad unit. This is essentially like a business partnership. And there are going to be influencers who deliver different results for you. So like one is like respecting the influencer relationship as a business partnership and treating it accordingly versus just, are we going to run a Facebook ad or are we going to like plug something with this influencer who's going to promote us and like call it a day? Influencers now touch so many different parts, from PR, marketing, content production, sales. There's so many different areas where you can incorporate influencers or creators that I think you really have to like, it's not a one size fits all solution. You have to respect them as business people. I've been very lucky in all of the creators that I've worked with, or like the 99% of the creators I've worked with have been super smart, entrepreneurial, mostly women. And a lot of them have gone on to start their own businesses. So like these are very smart entrepreneurial people. They're going to start their own traditional businesses that may even compete with yours one day, like work together with them, create a collaboration, a partnership where you're supporting each other's efforts versus thinking of them as the talent or just like the mouthpiece for a message. And then I think the other thing is getting really aligned internally on what an influencer can do for your business. And again, because it's not a one size fits all, I think sometimes, you know, people are hoping to drive sales and they're not seeing those conversions. Whereas the influencer that you hired and the type of content that they produced was really great for awareness, but wasn't necessarily going to convert. And so I think it's super important. I feel like this is where a lot of the disconnect comes in expectations between different people in the team of like, what is this influencer going to do for us? And you've got people who are going to create really engaging content. They're like trusted amplifiers of your message, really great for top of funnel. And that's a certain type of person and a certain type of content that is going to check that bucket. You've got people that are going to create great content, maybe nano or micro influencers that could create content not only for their channels, but also for your channels. And so thinking about them more as content creators for you. And then you've got the people that convert. But people that convert are very specific type of people. And I don't think somebody that's great at awareness is not necessarily great at conversion. You've got unicorns, like I'm thinking of Alex Earle and how well she does for the beauty business. Like, yes, Alex Earle is one of those rare people that can probably drive awareness, drive conversions all the way down, top to bottom of funnel, magical person. But there's only one of her, or, you know, maybe 10 of people like her that are able kind of to do that top to bottom. If you're looking for conversions, it's like, that's a specific type of person. That is a person who has warmed their audience, has their own product, does unboxing, does product reviews, does recommendations, does affiliates, is already in that world. And so they have an audience that is primed to shop or whatever it is that you're, you know, you're hoping to kind of convert. And so I think you need to look at, is this person already doing this? Do they have a good understanding? And is their audience embracing that? Do they look to this person for recommendations to understand, like, what is the latest and greatest lipstick, pair of shoes, television, headset to buy, you know, whatever it is. And those are the people that you need to work with if you're looking to drive conversions. So I think it's really important to be aligned internally on like what you think an influencer can do and have realistic expectations about the person you choose, the campaign, the type of content that gets produced, the people that you look at, Amazon Live, I'm sure even like TikTok shops, the people that are really good at live stream e-commerce are not necessarily the people that are good at, they don't have the most followers maybe. They're yep. not the people that you go to for the most entertaining content. So again, I think there's this understanding or expectation of an influencer that we set like 5-10 years ago of like, it's this type of person and this is what they're going to do. And I think it's just evolved so much and individual creators have evolved so much in what they're able to accomplish for you that I think it's really respecting the fact that different people have different skills and they're going to be able to help you accomplish different things. And so internally, you've got to be aligned. You've got to have the team members that are working with these different types of creators or influencers. And so that you can actually achieve what it is that you're hoping to do.
Well, Leah, I really appreciate you taking out the time and congrats again on all the success that you're having. I'm excited to continue following and reading myself and encourage everybody else to listen in too. And I'll see you in LA next week.
Yeah, thank you. Always good to talk.
All right. Bye, Leah.
Bye.
Be a friend, tell a friend, and subscribe. earned by Creator IQ. Creator IQ is your all-in-one solution to grow, manage, scale, and measure your influencer marketing program. Ready to unlock the power of the creator economy? Get started with a demo today at creatoriq.com.